were here last week, you realize we actually assigned some homework, so we got some people becoming up here and sharing. But you know, as I was driving over here, I saw this massive billboard that was advertising for zero-calorie hydration products. Last time I heard, wasn't that just water? So, and a word about the calendar. It's all based on Psalm 104. So if you, those of you who were with us a year ago, we went through Psalm 104. And that's all comes out of a lot of the teaching here in the class. So, you know, we haven't done a scientific discovery in over a month, so I thought I'd start the class with a discovery. Then I'll call up the four people who are been assigned to give a report on the opening part of Psalm 147. You know, as I mentioned last week, we've been going through the latter creation psalms. Psalm 104 speaks about God creating life and how all life is there to serve the needs of human beings, literally from beginning to end. And Psalm 139 talks about human creation. And then Psalm 147 and 148 that we're studying now talks about the physical creation. And this kind of reflects what you see in Genesis chapter 1, where you see three times the use of the word bara to create brand new out of nothing. First, for the physical creation, Genesis 1:1, and creation day 5 for the creation of the soulish life, and then finally creation of human beings on creation day 6. But how many of you have ever heard about the Great Wall? Does that make any sense, the Great Wall? The China Great Wall. Well,
they've got one in China.
They got one in China, yeah. But astronomers have something they also call the Great Wall. And it's about 650 million light years across. And that was back in 1997. Yeah, it beats the Great Wall in China. And at that time, it caused a disturbance because astronomers were looking at it and saying, the wall is too big. What they mean by too big is that it challenged the standard model of Big Bang cosmology. And but then they realized that we live in an inflationary hot Big Bang universe, and by the injection of inflation, which is now, if you're not familiar with the term, this is the idea that the universe goes through a very brief, extremely rapid period of expansion when it's about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. So it doesn't last long, only lasts for 10 to the minus 34 seconds. But during that time, the universe goes from being about the size of an electron to the size of a grapefruit. So that doesn't seem like much expansion. Yeah, but try squeezing that in to 10 to the minus 34 seconds. And what you have is a universe expanding far more rapidly than the velocity of light. And with that hyper-expansion of the universe taking place at that time, and let me just add this too, what drives that hyper-expansion is a breaking of symmetry forces, in the sense that this is when the universe goes from having one force of physics to having, two forces of physics to having three forces of physics. So this is that moment when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force and the force of gravity. And this is what drives the hyper-expansion. The first separation of forces stops the expansion of six dimensions of space. The second separation of forces causes the universe to hyperinflate. And with the understanding the universe hyperinflates, they were able to accommodate structures as large as 650 million light years across. And the real challenge here is that if the universe is Big Bang, you would expect that a Big Bang universe, starting off as homogeneous and uniform as a cosmic background radiation tells us it must be, that that's going to put a limit on future inhomogeneities in the future in the universe as it goes through its aging process. And so initially, Big Bang cosmology was predicting there would be no very large structures in the universe. But with the addition of inflation, we can accommodate structures as big as 650 million light years across. However, then we had the latest release of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And you say, what's that? This is almost a 20-year project now to map the galaxies in the universe and to map them on the largest possible scales. We're now talking hundreds of millions of galaxies that have been measured. In fact, just this week they released what they called the ninth release of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So the maps keep getting bigger and bigger. And they've now mapped about 25% of the universe through this digital survey technique. But the last two releases have revealed something called the Sloan Great Wall. It's no longer the Sloan Wall, it's the Sloan Great Wall. You can say, how big is this wall? 1.3 billion light years across. And we say a wall, what we mean by that is a contiguous set of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. So what you basically see in the universe is kind of a sheet out there where you've got galaxies virtually touching one another across about 1.3 billion light years.
When you say touching, what does that mean in your terminology?
Okay, what it means when astronomers say contiguous is that when they look at it through their telescopes, it looks like all the galaxies' light is blending together. Of course, there's spaces between them. But they're close enough together that at those great distances, they appear as a single filament or, in this case, a big sheet.
But they're not ripping each other apart.
Well, they are. I mean, lots of galaxies are close enough together that they're ripping one another up. In fact, you can see Andromeda tonight. If you look at Andromeda, even through a really good pair of binoculars in a dark site, you can see that its spiral structure has been warped by interactions with nearby galaxies. We live in one of the rare spiral galaxies where that has not happened. But your typical spiral galaxy, you'll see significant distortion as it's been beat up by gravitational interactions with galaxies around it. But remember we had that star party up in the mountains and we looked at M51, what's called the Pinwheel Galaxy. Even through my little small telescope, you could see a distortion in one of the spiral arms. So it's not that small, 11 inches, but that is small by professional standards. But back to this, the 1.3 billion light year sheet of galaxies was considered to be a threat even to inflationary hot Big Bang creation models. And so the Big Bang model has passed every possible test that's been thrown at it, except this one. It was looking like the structures were too big for them. We were going to have to make serious adjustments to the Big Bang model. But this paper got published in Astrophysical Journal Letters, literally just a couple of weeks ago, where they did the largest simulation of the history of the universe ever done to date. It's a factor of 10 larger than any other simulation. Say, what's a simulation? Well, what they typically do is they put billions of test particles into a computer where each of them has got some mass, and each test particle represents either a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies, and then they simply let the computer run and calculate the gravitational interactions amongst these galaxies, and then they actually have built into the model the formation of the galaxies from the Big Bang creation event. So you got the Big Bang creation event where you got nothing but gas and random fluctuations in that gas will cause little seeds to form, galaxies form. Then they trace the interactions of those future galaxies as you come up to the very present time and see whether or not the models would actually predict structures that big. Well, they published a paper pointing out that with this simulation, it's called the Horizon Run 2, and literally a factor of 10 bigger than any other computer simulation done of the history of the universe. And they said it predicts structures as big as 1.3 billion years in the context of a Big Bang model with inflation, where you got random density fluctuations that lead to gas condensations, the formation of galaxies. So the bottom line is that there's nothing wrong with a Big Bang model. There's nothing wrong with the Big Bang model that's dominated by dark energy, where dark energy is driven by a cosmological constant, where most of the mass of the universe is in the form of exotic matter, matter that doesn't interact well with light, which is exactly what the observations have been telling us, that the universe has about 5 to 6 times more exotic matter than ordinary matter, and where dark energy makes up about 73% of all the stuff for the universe, and also matches the best observations we have of the inflationary event. So can we actually get back to 10 to the minus 35 seconds? Well, you can by measuring the polarization in the cosmic background radiation. When we look at the radiation from the cosmic creation event, we're observing the universe when it was 380,000 years old. Say, how come you can't go any earlier? If you go any earlier, you're at that moment where the universe is too hot for atoms to form. And if it's too hot for atoms to form, you see no distinction between the dark or the cool spots of the universe and the hot spots of the universe. So when you're looking at the cosmic background radiation maps, you're looking at that first moment when light separates from darkness, or that first moment when atoms form. But by measuring the polarization in the hot and cold spots of that earliest look at the universe where we see distinction between dark and light, that actually tells you the condition of the universe when the strong nuclear force was separating out from the electroweak force at about 10 to the minus 34 to 10 to the minus 35 seconds ago. And we can actually even get some crude idea of what kind of inflation is taking place at that time. We know it's not simple inflation. And so that was actually built into this cosmological model, which said there's no problem with the universe having something as big as the Sloan Great Wall. Moreover, which I thought was really interesting for a bunch of theoreticians, and they're all Koreans, one American, actually a guy I knew from Caltech, Richard Gott, and the rest of them are Koreans, all theoreticians, is that they actually looked at the Sloan Digital Skies Survey latest release and said, we found something bigger than the Sloan Great Wall. Now, that wasn't a bunch of galaxies. What they found was a void. And that's what, you know, so it's a place where there are no galaxies. But in terms of Big Bang cosmology, the empty spots have as much significance as the places where you got galaxies. And this void they found was about 50% bigger than the Sloan Great Wall. But they said this too is predicted by our model, that we would get structures this big. And they concluded their paper by saying that when the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and more advanced surveys that are now on the planning books, when they are done, because the plan for astronomers now is to be able to do a survey of galaxies that's 4 times deeper than the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And their model predicts that when that survey results come in, we will find structures twice as big as the Sloan Great Wall. So that's not the biggest thing we're going to find, and that will be consistent with Big Bang cosmology. I see a hand over here, yes. The name of the paper is called The Challenge of the Largest Structures in the Universe of Cosmology, and it's in Astrophysical Journal Letters. There will be an article that will be posted on our reasons.org website. As a matter of fact, this is going to be released in our magazine. So the spring magazine that comes out will have an article on this and a little more detail I could give you today. Yes, Ross.
How do astronomers account for the clumpiness of the universe? Is it fair to say, or even ask the question, was the singularity clumpy in some way? How do you account for that?
Well, Big Bang cosmology tells us that the universe begins homogeneous and uniform. But as it expands under general relativity, and that's a key point, as it expands under general relativity, you will get random density fluctuations that will grow. And this is what produces the galaxies. That's been expected in Big Bang cosmology for a good 40 years now. But the big test is, does the predictions of Big Bang cosmology and general relativity square with the observations that astronomers are making of galaxies and super galaxy clusters. And this paper is basically saying, for 20 years now, we've been thinking that there's a big problem. We now know there's no problem. The Big Bang model is safe. And so one reason why I'm writing on this, this has been the one test of the Big Bang model where there's been any question or doubt. And so we can say that, you know, to this point, the Big Bang model has passed every test that's been thrown at it, including this latest one. Yes?
My understanding was that as of about 7 years ago, there was no mechanism for the coalescing of the primordial gas into galaxies that fit the timetable for the evolution of the Big Bang model.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to is the problem of getting the first stars, which, you know, again, produces the first galaxies. And there have been astronomers making the point that there isn't an adequate cooling mechanism to form the first stars that would actually explain the metal abundances we see in the later stars. And so this again...
Even worse than that, it was actually just the coalescing of the primordial gas to form galaxies, that you could introduce various different forms of dark matter and things like that with different gravitational constants and try to get things to clump together properly. But that it actually just... There was no mechanism they were able to come with that fit the timetable that we saw from the observations.
Well, I mean, this is interesting, too, because in the same, not the Astrophysical Journal letters, but the accompanying Astrophysical Journal had an article on that whole point. You know, can we explain galaxy formation, the formation of the first stars, without invoking decay of exotic mass particles? And, you know, there's some people who say we need that, some people say we don't need that. That's an ongoing discussion that's taking place. And, you know, the article basically says we can have it or we cannot have it. However, they were putting limits on how much decay. If you get too much decay of exotic mass particles, then you've got a conflict with observations. So they're basically saying if you got zero, it looks like you're okay. If you got a small amount of decay, and the whole point is, are the limits on the decay at a, such a point that we could actually observe their effects? And actually, there's an iron spectral line in the center of our galaxy that's quite sensitive to the decay of certain exotic mass particles. And there's measurements. There's an article on our website that actually talks about that.
The issue to me is if you have enough free parameters, you can fit almost any set of observational data. And just because you can build a self-consistent Big Bang model, doesn't mean that there aren't other possibilities that haven't been formed.
Well, that's true. I mean, for example, there's lots of articles talking about modifications to Newtonian mechanics that will produce models. But, you know, we've been following that of reasons to believe. And what's called the MOND model, this looks like it's falling from favor because there's been many tests that show that it doesn't work. And this is, again, in favor of Big Bang cosmology. The real battle is what kind of Big Bang are you looking at? And there's a lot we don't understand, you know, like what is the property of a hydrogen gas? And, you know, because there's H2, there's H3, and depending on the ratio of H2 to H3 before you got stars and galaxies, that can say a lot about what kinds of structures you get. But what the observations are telling us is you don't get big galaxies right off the bat. What you get are a lot of really tiny dwarf objects that have not yet formed stars, loaded with a lot of exotic matter. Then these begin to merge, and then you get galaxies. And actually, you get the stars before you get the galaxies. So,
as I said, if you have enough free parameters, you can fit almost any
observation. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not a solved problem yet, how you get the first stars, how you get the first galaxies. And part of the struggle in astronomy is being able to date accurately when you get the first stars and the first galaxies. If we can get really accurate dates to those first stars and first galaxies and the sizes of the first stars and the sizes of the first galaxies, we're going to get a much more precise creation model than we have right now. So that's kind of the goal of astronomy for the next 10 or 15 years, is to nail that down. In fact, the James Webb Telescope's primary objective is going to be to try to detect the first stars. As of right now, we don't have the instruments to detect the first stars. You see, that should be fairly easy because astronomers predicted those first stars are going to be really bright, more than 100 times the mass of our star, the Sun. The problem is they burn up pretty quickly, and which means you can only see them if you're looking 13.5 billion light years away, which means they're going to be super faint. But the James Webb Telescope is promising us that it's going to be powerful enough to detect those first stars. Now, we are able to detect our stars that are polluted by those firstborn stars. It's an interesting situation where you get this supergiant star that forms out of only hydrogen and helium gas. And this is kind of the difficulty this gentleman was raising. It's very difficult to form stars if you have no elements heavier than helium. And this is where they're invoking things like molecular hydrogen and hydrogen 3 in order to get these things to cool and form those first stars. We know we're not going to have a lot of these first stars, but what is interesting is you can have a star with nothing but hydrogen and helium inside of it, and it's very big, burns up quickly, but at the same time you got smaller pockets of gas that are forming. They're forming literally at the same time. But before the small star actually becomes a star, it gets polluted by the explosion of the really big star. So here you've got stars forming at the same time. But the metal-free star goes through its burning cycle so rapidly, it actually winds up polluting the star that was born at the same time, because the smaller the star, the longer it takes to form. And we do see those stars. We see them because they burn for a long, long time. So we don't have to look 13 billion light years away to see them. The fact that they can burn for 13 billion years means that they're around us today in our own galaxy. So we actually do see stars that are what they call extremely metal poor stars, which have the signature of being polluted by those firstborn stars. So that's the proof we have that the universe actually does form stars out of nothing but hydrogen and helium, because we can see the pollution signature of those first stars. But we've yet to see the first stars. Although, in one sense, we are seeing the first stars, because these small stars that form at the same time actually are visible today. But they were not fully formed at the time when there were no metals in the universe. All right. I didn't mean for this to get quite so off the track, but go ahead.
The gentleman next to me wanted to ask a question.
All right.
Yeah, Hugh, I have a couple of inane questions. Okay, does E equal MC square, does that apply to the cosmological
E equals MC squared does not apply to the space surface of the universe. That space surface can expand arbitrarily fast without violating special or general relativity.
Okay, so how about pre-Big Bang? See, the reason I ask the question is, to me that, you know, just in my puny mind, energy is converted to mass, right? Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, I'm glad you answered your own question.
because C doesn't exist before the Big Bang, right?
That's right.
Okay, so, see, I was thinking God spoke energy and then it converted to mass. No?
Well, the creation of the universe is God creating space and time. And very quickly, that space-time curvature gets released to make energy, which then produces matter. You really don't get the matter until the universe is, less than a 20th of a second old. So.
The other question was, how long did it take for that computer to simulate?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, we're talking a supercomputer that runs a long, long time before we get the result. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems in astrophysics that are limited by the size and the speed of the computers that are available to us. In fact, what's interesting is every year or two, astrophysicists get together and talk to people who make these computers and tell them, these are the problems we could solve if you would build X, Y, and Z. And that's actually a big motivation for them developing the next generation of computers. And it's still true, there's many outstanding problems that we can't even touch just because we don't have computers big enough and fast enough to do the problem. So yeah, this is a program that's running at the very limit of computer capability. I mean, it takes me back to my graduate school days where I ran programs that took 13 hours to run. So, but that was a time when there was just the one computer, period. So, yes.
I'm sorry I was late to the class, so if I'm not following you. But are you saying in time, no pun intended, but in time we can actually, the telescopes can look back to the actual split second after the Big Bang or the Big Bang itself?
Well, that's the beauty of astronomy. You get a direct window into the past. So I've mentioned here in the class before, we astronomers are totally ignorant of the present. We only know about the past because it takes like time to reach our telescope. So if you ask me what the moon is like right now, I can't tell you, but I can tell you what it was like a second and a half ago because that's how long it takes the light to reach us. And so by looking farther and farther away, you're looking farther and farther back in time. So one, in the sense that we have a time machine into the past. Now, how close can we get to the cosmic creation event? We can get within about 10 to the minus 35 seconds.
Can you go any further and see God?
Well, what we're literally doing, in one sense, is watching what God was doing from very shortly after the cosmic creation event right up to the present.
But you can't go before that. You can't see.
Well, you know, I think it's quite remarkable that we can get within a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. That's pretty close to the beginning.
Yeah, but I see God myself. I want to see before it.
That's in the future.
Yeah, you will see God in the future. However, what you are able to see, as the Bible points out, is the handiwork of God. You can watch what He was doing as, a creator each step of the way. And yeah, thanks to astronomy, we can literally go back to the cosmic creation event and watch His hand and pulling all of this together. But the reason why I brought this paper here is, you know, say, what's the big deal about this paper theologically? The theological point is this. Until the 20th century, the Bible stood alone as the only book teaching Big Bang cosmology. And here's a quiz for those of you who have been in the class for over a year. Where in the Bible does it teach Big Bang cosmology? And this is a huge factor for me personally in coming to faith in Christ, realizing that for thousands of years, the Bible is the only book that taught these elements of Big Bang cosmology.
Genesis 1, verse 1
is a good place to start.
Isaiah, Jeremiah.
Yeah, okay.
Time, space, matter, energy, the spirit realm, is that a residual effect from what Paul explained in Romans 1:20 about the invisible qualities of God besides divine nature and eternal power?
Well, I think you could try to pull that out of that. I think what Romans 1 is talking about is we look at the entire scope of creation, the handiwork of God that we see in the book of nature, and not only testifies of God's existence, it testifies of His personal attributes. So we can learn what kind of God is creating this universe, not just that it is a God. I mean, that's something you've been hearing from Paul Beck in the morning services, is that what we observe in creation is that there is love. Creatures love one another. We love one another. And therefore, the God of the universe, the one that created the universe, must be a loving being. And a loving being requires personal interactions. And the problem with the monotheistic religions is you've got God all by Himself with nobody to love. And how can such a being explain the existence of love in us human beings? And this is the whole point of Christianity, that God was engaged in love before He created anything. And that's possible with a triune God. Now you say, what about the polytheistic religions? Well, every polytheistic religion has multiple creators with different ideas about how to create. And this is why you see in Hinduism and Buddhism, for example, this idea that nature should have built within it things that are not harmonious. There should be internal contradictions. So as you look at the record of nature, we don't see that. everything looks like it's based on a single plan with great harmony and beauty and consistency. And this actually testifies of a triune God. You know, one essence, three persons. And so it's simply by looking at creation, we can discern some of these factors. But I think what you're referring to is the fact that there are many places in the Bible that tell us that the beginning of the universe is not just the beginning of stars and galaxies and matter and energy, it's the beginning of space and time itself. And this is one thing that does distinguish the Bible from other holy books. You know, when I was studying Hinduism and Buddhism, they were speaking about God creating, or gods actually, creating within space and time that eternally exists. The Bible departs from that and says, no, space and time don't exist until the universe is created by God. You know, and that is a core doctrine of Big Bang cosmology. But the Bible says more than that. Go ahead. You had your hand up. No?
Nope.
Anyone else? This gentleman.
I just happened to watch last night Dr. Leonard debating Richard Dawkins.
Yes.
And Dawkins said that the Bible got it right from the Big Bang model. We have only two choices. It was existing eternally before it just started. So he said, no big deal. Because we have only two choices. He said, okay, you got one out of, 50-50 choice. What is the response to that? Like,
well,
how big is this? Like, we got it right.
Okay. I mean, I had an opportunity to debate Victor Stenger at Caltech in front of the Skeptic Society. And I kind of took it one step further and said, the Bible not only talks about a beginning of the universe, it gives us details about how God shaped the universe and gave us details that qualify as predictions of future scientific discoveries. And the fact that it was the only book that made these predictions about the structure and the history of the universe confirms that the Bible has predictive power. And if it accurately predicts the future consistently on science and history, then it can't come from a mere human source. It must come from someone who has control over space and time. And this is the God of the Bible.
So you're saying the details of, okay, day one, light, day two, so-and-so, day three, and it matches the Big Bang model. So you're saying those little details, but they're not...
Well, if you were with our class about, 6-7 years ago now, we started off in Genesis 1, and there we talked about how when you go through the 6 days of creation, beyond the creation of the universe, it gives you a chronology of physical creation events that indeed perfectly matches the record of nature. With two provisos, we have to understand that the 6 days is being told to us from the point of view of an observer on the surface of the waters of planet Earth, looking up at the clouds, not down in the clouds, and that these days of creation are not 24-hour periods, but 6 consecutive long periods of time. And then you get a perfect fit. So I think we still have the audios of those things here. You remember now what your question was? Yes?
Identifying. I have a question.
Yeah, just a minute. Yeah, go ahead.
Right from the beginning, we started identifying the periods of time as days, but you don't have days until you have the sun, right?
Yeah, you don't have days until you have the Earth rotating and the sun existing, but all that is in place before the 6 creation days. You know, people who've made the mistake, I would argue, that the sun doesn't show up until the 4th day, ignore the fact that on creation day 4, it says that God made the sun, moon, and stars. And the verb saw is in the completed form, which means that by day 4, they're already completed entities. Now, that is confirmed through Job 38:8-9, where it tells us that before God did anything with the earth, He had blanketed the earth with clouds that were so dark it prevented any light from coming through, which tells us the sun, moon, and stars were already there, but the observer on the surface of the earth could not see the sun, moon, and stars because the primordial atmosphere a planet Earth would have been opaque to light. And on creation day one, let there be light. Light passed through the clouds for the first time, but it was overcast, so observers could still not see the sun, moon, and stars. Only on the fourth day did the sun, moon, and stars become visible as distinct objects in the sky. And what really nails that down is what you see in the following sentence after verse 14. It says, so that they may serve as signs to mark seasons, days, and years. And what you notice in Genesis 1 is all the life forms that is described in the Bible before day 4 doesn't need to know where the sun, moon, and stars are in the sky. But all the life forms mentioned in creation day 5 and 6 must have that information. And without that information, they're not able to regulate their biological clocks. And the fact that Genesis 1, 14, and 15 target the reason for the visibility of the sun, moon, and stars to these creatures in the surface of the earth confirms what you see in Job chapter 38.
So how do you conclude that if man was standing on the surface of the earth and he looked up and couldn't see light?
We're not talking about men. I'm just saying that the...
No. How does that correlate with the scientific
data? Well, it does...
You said that the clouds are impenetrable to light, right?
Yeah, okay. As an astronomer who has studied planet formation, once you get a planet the size of the Earth at the appropriate distance that the Earth is from the Sun, its primordial condition will be opaque. In fact, the amazing thing is this. It should have remained opaque. And so there were miraculous events that took place in the early history of the solar system that transformed our planetary atmosphere from opaque to translucent and finally to transparent. If there hadn't been intervention, we would have still to this day had an opaque atmosphere. In fact, a good example is Venus. If you look at Venus, it's opaque to all light that's not red or infrared because it has this thick atmosphere. And Earth had an atmosphere three times thicker when it was first formed. But because of the moon-forming event, we lost about 99.5% of our atmosphere. And that was one of the events that was responsible for our atmosphere being transformed.
That was the collision event?
Yeah, that's where... Well, I don't know if I've ever discussed this in the class before, but there's actually a paper that's been published that solves in detail the problem of how we wound up with such a thin atmosphere and such a glorious moon. And it's the fact that the early solar system had two planets sharing the orbit of the Earth. You had the Earth, and then you had another planet called Theia. Which was 60 degrees back along the orbital path of the Earth, which we know in physics is what's called a Lagrange point, which means that you can actually have a stable planet sharing the same orbit as long as it's 60 degrees back along the orbit or 60 degrees forward. Now, there's a caveat to that. It's stable literally for billions of years if you're looking at only three bodies, where you got a star and you got two planets sharing the same orbit. But given that we live in a solar system where you got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, it will not be stable over billions of years. And so what happens is that the smaller the two planets begins to creep towards planet Earth. And after a certain amount of time has gone by, it winds up hitting the Earth with a low velocity collision at a high attack angle, and it collides into an extremely deep ocean. And by colliding into that deep ocean, Earth winds up not being destroyed. If it wasn't for the ocean, our planet would have been destroyed. But thanks to that very deep ocean being transformed into steam, it blew off our atmosphere, got rid of about 99.8% of all of our water, and wound up forming the moon. I also wound up enriching our planet with lots of heavy metals.
Is that day one then?
Well, that would have all happened, somewhere before day one or at the very beginning of day one. So, Yes, question right here. Go ahead.
Yes. What type of star was the star that we now know as the Star of Bethlehem?
Oh, boy. Well, I got to be careful here because that was actually the subject of the sermon this morning. So although I noticed Paul Beck was carefully sidestepped trying to identify what the star is. And there's been a lot of debate. In fact, I've got a whole, almost half a bookshelf of books written by different astronomers on what they thought the Star of Bethlehem was. And you can go to our website and you'll see a couple of articles I've written on that. And just basically making the point. Number one, the Magi, as Paul Beck pointed out, would have had held Daniel, in very high esteem. He was the chief of the Magi at the time of the Persian Empire. And consequently, they would have held him in quite high esteem. And the only prophet in the Bible that predicts the timing of the coming of the Messiah is Daniel. It's Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27. So you can check that out. He actually talks about what period of time would transverse between the decree by Xerxes to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the coming of the Messiah. Actually lays out a certain number of years, 483 years would transpire. Now, there's a little bit of confusion on that because there's actually two decrees that you see recorded in Nehemiah and Ezra, and they have two different dates, but the dates are relatively close together, and so the whole point is these Magi would probably be looking at about a 10-year window when they knew that the Messiah would come and would have been watching for some kind of sign of that coming. And it says they saw a star, and based on seeing that star, they decided to go to Jerusalem and see if they could find this predicted king and Messiah that Daniel spoke about. And that's one thing. Daniel made it really clear that this newborn king would indeed be the Messiah, God himself. And so on that basis, they considered it definitely worth their while to go to Israel to see if they could worship this predicted coming Messiah. Now, the remarkable thing about the Magi, they had those three verses. That was it. And based on those three verses, they were prepared to spend a significant portion of their wealth. Because developing that kind of journey with those gifts would have required a great expenditure. And I do agree with Paul Beck. It had to be more than three kings. As he pointed out, they weren't kings. They were literally magi. But it said it threw the whole city of Jerusalem astir when they arrived. So this had to be a major entourage. But the thing that the text is very careful in pointing out, the star did not point the way to the newborn king. It simply indicated the timing. As you can see in Matthew chapter 2, what you got Herod saying to them is, well, go and search out. So the star wasn't going to help them find the location. But knowing that it was Bethlehem, that's what they discovered when they came to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, they inquired of the scribes and Pharisees, and they said Micah 5:2 predicts the location. It's Bethlehem. It's only 7 miles south of here, and it's a tiny village. You have no trouble finding a couple with a firstborn son. And that's the whole point. The star was not necessary to find the location of Jesus. It's the timing. And that's the other thing you see in Matthew chapter 2. It tells us that when they're on their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, the star reappeared. And it reappeared in the same location that it appeared to them when they saw it in the east, which is my main criticism against the idea that it's a conjunction of planets. The idea that you would get a conjunction of planets reappearing in the same form, in the same location in the sky, I don't know if that's ever happened. Moreover, the text says aster, the word Greek word for star, and it's in the singular. Conjunctions of planets means you've got two objects. Although there is one individual, a lawyer, and not an astronomer, who has written that that would be consistent with Jupiter and Venus coming so close together they would appear as one star. And he's right. I think in 1 BC, you had Jupiter and Venus coming together so close that everybody would see it as a single star. If you were living a long ways from Jerusalem, the problem is that they come together as one object for only a little less than an hour, and then they separate enough that you see them as two objects. Yeah, Venus moves fairly fast in the sky, and so having them close enough together that you would see them as a single star, it's just a brief moment, and that does not line up with people looking at the night sky in the area of Jerusalem, or for that matter, in Persia. Moreover, it's the wrong date. 1 BC is considered to be too late by most scholars for the birth of Jesus.
Because of Herod.
Herod was alive, and Herod died in 4 BC. And some say, well, maybe we can stretch that to 3 BC, but you're not going to stretch it to 1 BC. So that eliminates that possibility. Now, my personal favorite, I don't think it's a comet. I don't think it's a supernova, because it would have been picked up by other people. The interesting thing about the Matthew 2 account, it only shows up in Matthew 2. And so you don't have the Chinese or the Japanese or the Indians or the Egyptians or the Greeks recording it. It seems to be limited just to the Bible, which means it would have to be an event that only somebody really looking intently at the sky would spot. And so my personal favorite possible explanation, I emphasize possible because there's other possibilities, is that it's a recurring nova. Some people suggest it's a supernova, but a supernova is a one-shot deal. It's not going to recur. And the interesting thing about a recurring nova is that you do see nova that explode and re-explode anywhere from a year to 2 to 3 years later. And I think that's significant because Matthew 2 says that Herod, after being tricked by the Magi, because the Magi promised that we would tell you everything, but you remember in the text, they got a dream, and the dream told them, don't go tell Herod anything. So they simply went back to their home country without communicating with Herod. Herod was angry, and he sent soldiers to kill every male child 2 years of age or younger.
He was a murderer to begin with. He killed his three sons.
That's right. And he literally killed all the young boys in the town of Bethlehem in order to make sure he would remain the only, quote, king of the Jews. But what that tells me is there was probably at least a year between the first appearance of the star and the second appearance of the star. Something more than a year and something less than 2 years in order to explain Herod's actions, and that really fits quite well what you'd expect from a recurring nova, that it would explode and re-explode. Another beautiful thing about it is it would explode in exactly the same position in the sky. And so the Magi would have realized this as the star we saw in the east. That would not be the case with a conjunction of planets. Okay, we got an amateur astronomer in the back. Yeah.
Well, this is an astronomy question, but it seems to me that the one-year separation there was kind of large because Joseph and Mary had gone to Nazareth for a census, and then one would think the census had taken place. They were told instead of going back, going from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and then they'd be going back to Nazareth within a year's period of time, but they were still in Nazareth, told to go to Egypt, and then went back to Nazareth. That seems like that would be compressed in less than a year. I'm also kind of wondering why you wouldn't think, since it was only the Magi that saw even a recurring nova, considering other cultures having a lot of astronomers interested in changing skies, that just an angelic view that only they saw would be a better explanation.
Well, let me add this one other detail. There is a record in the Korean and Chinese astronomical recordings where they claim to have seen a new star, which is a term for a nova, in 4.5 BC. And so some people suggested that might be the star of Bethlehem. They say, why didn't they record the recurrence? Well, recurring nova don't always recur with the same brightness. You know, it may have been second magnitude when it first appeared, which would be roughly about the brightness of, say, the star Polaris. But on its second appearance, it might have been fourth magnitude, which would explain why the Koreans and the Chinese missed the recurrence, But the Magi wouldn't have missed it because they realized they would have probably been looking in that spot in the sky every night and they would have seen it. That's one possible explanation. However, there's a little bit of ambiguity as to exactly what was recorded in the Korean and Chinese records. But they did say we saw a guest star at this particular date. But they don't give the location of the guest star, so we don't know where it is in the sky and whether it would be, although it'd be roughly the same latitude as what the Magi would have been dealing with. So it could be. Now that's about the limit of everything we know about the Star of Bethlehem. Beyond that, there's a lot of speculation.
What
yes.
About, what about the time compression transfer going from Nazareth to Bethlehem and back?
Well, a lot of people read the gospel accounts that they went from Bethlehem, Nazareth to Bethlehem, had the baby, and the baby was born in a manger in a stable. But once the baby was born, and after the census was taken care of, they settled down in Bethlehem. They found a place to live. And, they didn't go to Egypt until such a time as the boy was able to be undertake such a journey. You literally don't take a newborn in that kind of a journey. So they would have had a motivation to stay in Bethlehem at least for a few months. And then they were told in a dream, Herod's going to come for you and then go to Egypt. And the reason why I say somewhere between a year to a year and a half, it's based on the fact that the text says Herod killed all the boys 2 years of age or younger. Now, it also tells us that he carefully inquired of the Magi, when did you see the star? So Herod knew how much time had gone by from the first appearance of the star and when the Magi showed up in Jerusalem. And it says they threw the whole city into a stir. So I would imagine this would have taken at least several months for them to get all the equipment together, the finances, and then actually mount the journey and arrive in Jerusalem. That's not something you do in a few weeks. It would take a much longer period of time. And then they went from Egypt back to Nazareth.
And that was because they didn't want to go back to Bethlehem for fear of further reprisal.
They did not want to go back to Bethlehem because they had heard about all the baby boys being killed. And they thought, Herod might figure out he missed his chance and would come back. So that's when they went back to Nazareth. So, yeah, that's one fun thing we did in the church many years ago. We actually did kind of a stage scene acting out the whole geography of what happened in the first few years of Jesus' life. And also pointed out that the family, once they settled in Nazareth, actually came to Jerusalem every single year for the Passover. Because it tells us that Jesus kept the law. And that meant that he and his family were actually showing up in Jerusalem every year, which refutes the idea that he went to India for 12 years. You wouldn't be going, you wouldn't be keeping the Sabbath every year if you were doing that. Yes, go ahead.
Just a quick question. Am I imagining this, or in the story about the events surrounding the death of these children? Doesn't it say something about Ramallah? No?
Okay. No. You're thinking back into the Old Testament where it predicts that there would be great weeping.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it...
Ramah.
Yeah.
Or Ramah.
Which would have included the region of Bethlehem. So, but it's referring to a much larger region than just Bethlehem itself. No. No, that's a modern name. Yeah, and today there's a city called Ramallah. In the West Bank, but the two aren't consistent with one another. Okay, you are next.
A two-part question in terms of timing. How long, when the nova appears, how long does it stay visible to the human eye?
Okay, there are different categories of nova.
This one.
Okay, well, we don't know. I mean, yeah, I can give you kind of a range. Some novae will remain bright for 6 or more months. Some remain bright for only a few days. Okay, so it's somewhere between a few days to as much as 9 months that they'll stay bright. and then they dim, and when they dim, they become invisible to the naked eye. And then when they recur, they'll come back to roughly the same brightness. And in terms of peak brightness, unless the nova is very close to our sun, it's somewhere no brighter than the star Polaris. For example, for the last 2,000 years, we've not seen a nova brighter than the star Polaris. So it would explain why, for example, the Chinese and the Indians and the Egyptians missed recording this thing. If it's that faint, they could have easily missed it.
And the other question is, when you're talking about the creation, and you say end time was instituted, would it be possible that time was created because of man? Not just the seasons, but because man needs to be mortal, you know, he lives for a certain period of time. Would that be the purpose of time?
That's one purpose of time. Now, I would agree with that. But one reason why we live in a universe with three large, rapidly expanding dimensions of space and a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed, that's the best space-time configuration for restraining the expression of evil by wicked human beings. So, and what we notice when we go to the new creation, we get different dimensions. So the dimensions we experience now, we will not be experiencing in new creation. These are dimensions that God created in part to deal with the problem of evil. And when evil no longer exists, there's no longer a need for those space-time dimensions. However, there are more reasons than just that for why you would want to have, for example, if you want planets and stars and moons, that's only going to work if you've got three large dimensions of space. Otherwise, the orbits will not be stable.
Well, in the millennium, if that belief is concrete, then man is living much longer. It has to do...
Okay, there's many different positions on the millennium. Now, I'll give you my personal position, which is that it happens before the return of Christ to planet Earth. I mean, he comes, reigns for 1,000 years, and then we have the new creation, which is known as a premillennial view. There's also an amillennial view, which is there's no actual millennium, and then there's a postmillennial view. But in the premillennial view, the millennium happens right here on the Earth without any change in the physics. The physics doesn't change until evil is done away with once and for all. And if you look at Revelation 19 and 20, it speaks about how Christ will reign personally here on planet Earth for 1,000 years, and during those 1,000 years, he locks up Satan. But at the end of the 1,000 years, he releases Satan to test the children born during the millennium. And the principle is this: no human being gets to enter into the new creation without being subjected to the most difficult test in the context of evil. This is how we gain eternal security. If God puts you through the most difficult test and you pass that most difficult test, nothing can ever threaten you from that point forward, which is why we have free will beings in the new creation with no possibility of evil coming back again. They've all been tested by the most challenging tests, which explains why at the end of the millennium, God releases Satan. Everybody must be subjected to the most difficult tests. He is the most powerful creature he ever created, which means we are being subjected to the most difficult test or temptation in the context of evil. Now, the good news is this. God is like a benevolent professor. He says, you, the student, are going to be taken through this most difficult test, but I am here to help you. And let me tell you something. You can't pass the test without my help, but I want to help you. And if you receive my help, you will pass this test, and you will enter into the new creation where evil will never be a factor ever again. But the millennium is here on Earth, and people will live longer, but they live longer in the days before the flood. And this is basically what it's saying about the millennium, that people will live much longer than they live now. It doesn't say they'll live forever. It just says they'll live much longer. And they said a man will be considered to have died in his youth if he dies at an age of 100 or 200 years. Okay? We actually have a gentleman right here who's 100 years old.
What?
Yeah? Yeah, right here.
You're kidding.
And in the millennium, he'd be considered a young man.
Different studies and so forth, but it looks like the heart of man might still have an inclination towards rebellion, because otherwise during the millennium you'd have not only the laws, some pretty serious enforcement, but you also have God's mandate that if you don't come, you don't send an ambassador, a representative to Jerusalem, then I will withhold the rain. So he would not have a reason to withhold the rain unless rebellion is still left in the heart of man, even though the demonic...
Well, that's true. Yeah. Well, here's the situation. I believe that the millennium is a gigantic object lesson where God is trying to drive home one more lesson, not just for our benefit, but for the benefit of the angels. Because when we sin, we come up with lots of excuses. You know, I had a bad family upbringing.
Yeah.
I was raised in a home where it was poverty. And there was bad influences all around me. Or Satan made me do it. Or, you know, it's the fact that, you know, we kill animals. And so what does God do during the millennium? There's no carnivorous activity. He gets rid of all that. He locks up Satan. He makes sure that we have a wonderful economy here on planet Earth. And you can't blame the politicians, because what he does is he brings back redeemed human beings from heaven, now in a perfected state morally, and they are the rulers and the teachers. So you can't blame your teachers, can't blame your political leaders. You can't say, I didn't know God existed. He's going to be ruling in downtown Jerusalem. You'll be able to watch him on television every night. And you'll be able to see his miracles. As you pointed out, he can withdraw rain just by his will or bring it back. And so people will be consistently seeing all of his miracles. Now, you would think with all that evidence, everybody would believe. And this is a chilling thing of Revelation chapter 20, is that when Satan is released at the end of the millennium, the majority of the children choose to receive the temptation from Satan and rebel, which kind of underlines the message of Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. The reason why we sin, the reason why we rebel, is our human heart. It's not our external experience. It's not our family heritage. It's not the fact that we didn't know, or the fact that, quote, Satan tempted me beyond my capabilities. It's your heart that's the problem. The problem is, very few human beings believe that. So I believe God's going to give us a 1,000-year object lesson where that lesson will be driven home really big time. You say, why does God do that? I don't think it's just for our benefit. He's also wanting to get that point across to the angels.
It's a foundation of witness to eternity that how man...
Well, you've got a good point, because it tells us in Revelation 21 that God's going to be creating kingdoms in the new creation, and that we humans will not only be ruling over the angels, we'll be ruling over whatever God creates. And they're going to need that lesson, perhaps. I mean, a lot of this is speculation.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that what I'm telling you, because, I mean, even on our Reasons to Believe staff, I've got people that disagree with my interpretation of all this. But from my perspective, it fits the object lesson that we see of the flood. I look at the flood as being an object lesson, at least in part. And this would be consistent with how God dealt with humanity at the beginning of his sojourn on earth, how he deals with them at the end. Now, I promised you guys that you'd be giving a report. So you've got 2 minutes to give your report. No, I'm not going to do that to you. But let me announce this. Next week, we're going to start immediately. And I got the names down here. Just want to make sure you're all prepared. And by the way, I'm going to recommend this. We do Old Testament first and New Testament second. I think you've got plenty to do in one class period, just looking at the Old Testament. So that'd be Peter DeMuth, John and Gloria Davis, and Sue Davis are on the dock to give us a report on what the entire Bible's got to say about stars. Say, why are we doing this? Because Psalm 147 and 148 speak extensively about God creating stars. They're big in his mindset. And what I wanted to do is drive home here for the class how important this topic is by actually taking you through the entire Bible and seeing everything it says about stars. God cares a lot about the stars. Now, stars are nothing but gas. And if God cares that much for gas, how much more must he care for you as a human being?
Would you like to
that? That'll be your job next week. So.
One more question.
Yes.
So the idea that predestination is that, yes, it's heaven, right? In the tribulation period. So does that mean Calvin is right and Wesley's wrong?
Well, I put it this way. I think Wesley's right. I think Calvin's right. They're both right. The reason why you get a battle between Wesleyanism or Arminianism and Calvinism is that people are trying to resolve the paradox of human free will and divine predetermination in a single dimension of time. And in a single dimension of time, it can't be done. For the same reason, you're not going to be able to resolve the paradox of the Trinity if you try to resolve it in the context of three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Now, God created our universe of space and time. He's not limited by our space-time dimensionality. He's bigger than that. And if you allow God to be big enough, you can have God predetermining every thought you think, every word you speak, every action you perform from the time you're born to the time you die, and at the same time give you complete free will to determine the way that you will live. So God can hold you responsible for every thought, word, and action that you perform. At the same time, he can predetermine every word, thought, and action. I think you can understand now why there's been a battle over this, because that doesn't seem to make any sense in the context of three space dimensions and one time dimension. One has to be right, the other has to be wrong. But if you allow God to be big enough, they can both be simultaneously right. If you want to see a demonstration of that, there's a book over here called Beyond the Cosmos, where I show you three different ways you can have human free will and divine predestination if you allow God to operate in at least the equivalent of three dimensions of time. Now, all three of the resolutions I give you in the book quite probably are wrong. I'm just simply saying, if you allow God to be big enough, here are three ways you can make it work. God's got an infinite number of ways of making it work since he's not subject to space and time, and he can create dimensions at will. And who says there aren't dimensions that are bigger than what space and time will allow, like super dimensions? So I'm not claiming to give you the solution. I'm just saying solutions must exist if we allow God to be as big as what the new physics tells us he must be. And so, yeah, the book kind of gets you into Big Bang cosmology, and it gets you into some particle physics and shows you at a minimum what astronomers and physicists have established about the power of God, and saying that alone is sufficient to have Wesley and Calvin be good friends. And I'm sure they're good friends right now.
Sorry. Optimist.
So the concept of holiness, which is explained in the term sanctification, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So does that, I mean, if people are on different stages on the road.
Well, I'm out of time, but let me give you a little hint on this. What you see in Paul's writings is that when we humans who are in Christ make a decision, there's actually three components to that decision. There's the expression of my will, but I'm also being influenced by the will of Christ. I'm also being influenced by the will of Satan. And depending how I exercise my free will, that can diminish the power of the will of Satan in my life, and it can increase the power of Christ in my life. And what Paul explains is, as we practice that throughout our life, as we walk with Christ, we can use our will to become a captive of Christ. But it can go the other way, where the rebel winds up becoming a captive of Satan. And what I mean by that is where the will of Satan in your life has been made so strong by your own actions and the own expression of your will, because every time you choose to rebel against God, that strengthens the will of Satan in your life. You can actually make that will so strong that no possible combination of your will and God's will overcome it. But there's a flip side to that. You can make the will of Christ in your life so strong that no combination of Satan's will and your will overcome it. That's how we become captives of Christ. That's how we become captives of Satan. And God leaves us alive here on planet Earth long enough until we become one or the other. But according to what you see in the New Testament, nobody dies sitting on the fence where they're halfway between one and the other.
Amen.
So you get a choice who you want to be a captive of. So you can exercise your free will in that direction. That's a whole lot more than I intended to say. Let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for the diverse discussion we had today. And we ask your hand of blessing on Peter DeMuth and John and Gloria Davis and Sue Davis as they report back to us next week on their discoveries of what your book tells us about this world of the stars. And Lord, how much you care for the stars. And how those stars are there in place to serve us. And Lord, therefore, how much you must care for us. So, Father, as we looked at this incredible universe that you've created, may that humble us as to who we are in your eyes. And therefore, may we take seriously these few years we have on planet Earth and live our lives in such a way as to glorify you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.